maybe I should add a little bit more here. So I said we derived this Lagrangian density, we derived, but we did not derive exactly just it was a kind of guess, and then eventually it worked. We saw that by using Euler-Lagrange equation, we could get a Dirac equation. Just a little bit more about this term. Certainly, it's connected with this property of where it is. It's here. This commutator. Okay. Okay. Yeah, this is, let me say something about this stuff. So I said that it looks like this property implies that gamma mu transformed as vector, because we had same actually J in the case of vector field. Is it here? Sorry. Maybe I had something better for where? No, it's different. Lambda 1/2 gamma mu lambda 1. This. So we had, do you have this? I mean, this relation. Lambda minus 1/1/2 gamma mu lambda 1/2 equal. And lambda mu nu gamma mu. It should be. No, it's not here. Here? Oh, yes. Yeah, sorry. Okay. So this. And I said it looks like transformation like vector. OK, of course, from mathematical point of view, I was asked later by a student, one should say that it's formal relation. And if we act on gamma mu matrices by those generators or elements of Lorentz group, then on the right hand side we will get combination which correspond to transformation of the vector. But actually it indeed implies that something is transformed as vector. I said two. For example, let us look on this quantity, psi bar gamma mu psi. And let's consider its transformation. We know that psi bar psi is scalar, right? I showed. Now, Lorentz transformation. OK. We know how those psi and psi bar transform. Then we know we should substitute. This goes psi bar and lambda 1/2 minus 1. This is what I showed here, right, in the class, that psi bar, it's here, right? This is 3. So I substitute instead this stuff. Now I wrote gamma mu and substitute usual lambda 1/2 psi here, right? Now let us look at this combination. It's exactly what we have on the right hand side, right? So this is, I will write equal, and then I write, okay, how lambda, right, mu nu, right. And here I have psi bar gamma nu psi. And what is conclusion? Conclusion is that psi bar gamma mu psi is a vector for component vector, right? Transformation properties exactly like for the coordinate. So it's certainly important here. So this term psi bar m psi is scalar, as I said. But this term psi bar gamma mu psi is vector. But because of contraction with d mu, we have again scalar. Right? So this is quite important point. So this is, you can consider as formal relation. But this relation provide properties, transformation properties under Lorentz group of this, let's say, bifermion composite field, like this one. It's bifermion because two fields and composite, right? And because of that, we get that it's real vector field, right? So it's important point here. Okay, so this is some questions here. Is it clear?
Mm-hmm. Can we construct a pseudo-scalar?
Yeah, I will later consider all possible and important combination people use in, certainly we could, but it will happen next week. But sure, it's possible, and tensors and so on. Okay. Now, another important very thing, which is called, apparently I don't need this stuff, this part, what is called Weyl fermions, special, not Dirac fermions, but Weyl. This is name of mathematicians. I already used this name today. It's great German mathematician who contributed a lot in the development of quantum mechanics and also some other area of math. Actually, by the way, he was crucial for Schrödinger to write that famous Schrödinger paper with his equation. He actually taught Schrödinger how one can solve boundary value problem and get spectrum. So there is acknowledgement in that famous Schrödinger paper, acknowledgement to Weyl. They both worked at Zurich in Switzerland at that time. Okay, so let me. Okay, point is, let us look at the form of our S mu nu generators, which acts on component of side field. They are right there. S O I, Look, it's block diagonal. Sigma I minus sigma I. Look at Sij. It's again block diagonal. It means the following, that spinors. So let me put here equation. It was the last third four. So equation four imply that if I write like psi, which is four component, and I write first two component psi L, later I explain meaning psi R, then psi L, which is two component, and psi R transform independently under Lorentz transformation. Under transform independently. Under Lorentz group. It's clear, right? So no mixing between them. In mass, it means that when we have, as in our case, that we have no mixing between under transformation between parts of my field, then we say that this field corresponds to reducible representation of Lorentz group. This means that psi is a sign to a reducible representation of Lorentz group. Actually, this guy corresponds to the group we call 1/2 0, and this guy correspond 0 1/2, and this is, and we will describe now those two representation. People say we have reducible representation, and it's direct sum of two. It means that you just have two independent representation. So this is psi L, psi R. Okay. Now let's look at this point in more detail. You can try, but first it's better to remove So let us look in more detail on the transformation. Okay, let me, still I can use that. So essentially they're connected with four, and then all our lambda for Dirac field is this. Right, and this form is written here. Okay, so let's consider infinitesimal the stuff. Let's consider infinitesimal rotation and boost. Then, because of this block diagonal form, you can check that it looks like that. Psi L goes 1 minus I theta sigma over 2, yeah? Sorry. Minus beta sigma over 2 psi L. So this comes just from this upper part of our matrices, right? And I use theta and beta we used in the very beginning of the class to substitute omega mu nu through this boost parameter. And this is usual angle parameter connected with three Pauli matrices. Okay, difference huge because I is here, rotation, unitary transformation, no I here. Okay, on the other hand, psi r, it's not surprising, should be the same rotation because it's the same thing here. But another sign for boost. So you can see now that they transform indeed independently. And the only difference is in boost, Lorentz transformation. Pure rotational, say, and it's clear from this form. Now, so people say like the statement like that they transform identically under rotation. They say psi L, this is the sign, transform like psi R under rotations. No difference between them. Now, let us show that psi r transforms as psi sigma 2 psi al complex conjugate under both rotational and boost transformation. Okay. By the way, it will, so it means this form, psi r, and we can write sigma 2 psi l, right? By the way, this implies that sigma 2 psi l star transform like psi l itself under rotation. Because look, this guy transform like psi r under both rotational and boost transformations. On the other hand, psi r transform as psi l under rotational. Then it implies that this guy transform like psi l under rotational. You can check this. But of course, it will follow from my consideration. This is quite interesting property, actually, which is important, for example, in the standard model. This is connected with special property of rotational group. OK. So check. We will use identity. For that, which is the sigma 2, when it multiplied by sigma any Pauli matrices star equal minus sigma, same sigma 2. So this property. Okay, so now let's consider psi. We know this guy, how he transformed psi L. Now let's take complex conjugation for psi L just by using this. Psi L complex conjugate goes and just 1 plus I theta sigma complex conjugate over 2 minus beta sigma complex conjugate over 2 psi L. OK, now multiply by sigma 2. Sigma 2 psi L complex conjugate and use this property. Then it goes like that. 1 plus I, and then we have sigma 2 theta 2 minus sigma 2 beta sigma 2, and this is psi L. Now let us put sigma 2 commutes, sigma 2 and sigma vector star in both cases by using this star. Then we have minus additional, right? So it goes, or maybe we can write equal, right? Just sigma 2 psi goes, which is equal, right? We can write psi L and equal 1 minus I theta sigma 2 and minus, so I should put plus beta right sigma over 2 sigma 2 psi L, right? So I used this stuff, right? But this is exactly transformation for psi r. Look on the transformation psi r. Okay? So we have now same sign for rotational, but different sign for boost. So it's correct. So it means this important thing. So how much you need? 30, 20 minutes?
Oh, 20 minutes is fine.
20?
Yeah.
So maybe then I will take another 5 minutes and stop here. Okay, is it clear? No questions here? What is going on? So we prove this. I can put QED. It means we proved. I believe it's Latin, right? Maybe somebody of you know what it means literally. Okay. So it's nice. Now I still have this. I can use this. I will use smaller letters. Okay. Now we can rewrite in terms of psi L and psi R. So I can tell you L means left-handed, R right-handed, but I will explain later what it means. It's connected with helicity of some states, connected with this stuff, but don't worry about it. Just consider like some letters, and that's it. Psi L and psi R. Dirac equation, our equation is, right? So just we can substitute now explicitly psi L, psi R in Dirac equation, and we will get this. E gamma mu d mu minus m psi. Now substitute, and we will get this block matrix. Each block 2 by 2. This graph. Then we have I d 0 minus sigma grad minus m, and this guy x psi al psi r, and this is equal 0. Okay. Point is for m equals 0, psi L and psi R are not mixed. Let's write two equations for them in this case. So m put 0, then we have two equations. So this guy, I d 0 minus this guy x on psi L, and this this guy x on psi r, m equals 0, right? So we have d 0 just different sign, sigma, right, psi r equals 0. So for massless particles, we have two types of fields, which are called whale fields. Not Dirac. And this equation, each of them called whale equation. So Weyl discovered this equation, I would say quite soon after Dirac derived his equation. But Pauli, who was very critical, he immediately noted that those equations are not they are invariant under Lorentz group, but they are not invariant under parity. Parity transformation when all spatial coordinate goes to minus. And he said, they are wrong. But now we know that parity is not conserved in nature since the work of Young and Lee in 50s. And actually, neutrino could be described at least in approximation when we ignore. Now there are new information that maybe neutrino have small masses. But at least in very good approximation, neutrino of the standard model are described by those equations. OK, so maybe it's better. Yes, please.
These two equations,
right.
Are
no, as I said, those guys related to different representation of the Lorentz group. And their non-equivalence means that particles connected neutrino, say, left-handed and right-handed is different in the following quantum numbers. I will come to that, which is called helicity. Helicity is projection of the momentum over spin. So in the case of left-handed, spin is always is in opposite direction of momentum. But in the case of right-handed right, spin actually is along direction of momentum. So they are quite different. OK, so we will come to that. So actually, what we use, at least in the theory before discovering those small masses of neutrino, this is essentially left-handed neutrino. In experiment of weak interaction, we have always neutrino, which has negative helicity. It means that spin and momentum are in the two different directions, always like that. So they're quite different, right? And it's quite interesting and important issue of the high energy physics now and astrophysics, of course, essentially. OK, so I will stop here. And now let's, it's a kind of will be experiment. So Chris will present. Please introduce what you will talk about.
Yeah, Chris. Dr. Maransky asked me to talk about a subject.
I just wash my hands.
Sure. That's at the end of chapter 2. And it's about particle creation by classical source. And I think one of the important.
You lost.
Yeah, so one of the reasons he wanted me to talk about this was because there were a few questions about the Green's functions, the retarded and Feynman propagator last class. So a couple of those subtleties come into the calculation that's in this section. So it's a really simple assumption to start out, and it's that we have just a normal Klein-Gordon field, and this is coming straight out of Heskin and Schober. But hopefully I can provide a bit of insight into some things. we have a normal Klein-Gordon field coupled to some classical source, J. So it's not an operator, but it's a field over space-time. And again, I just want to point out that solutions to a Green's function is a solution to the associated particular problem having, so let's call this the Green solution. If you have a forcing function on this side, Green's function is the solution to this with the delta function on that side. And its usefulness is that if you have a solution to the homogeneous problem, then you can construct the general solution to this particular problem by performing an integral Green's function. But you can have different Green's functions that satisfy this equation, basically because of the ambiguity or the freedom in solving differential equations. And that's where we get these different Green's functions, like the Feynman and the retarded Green's function. And we did that by doing the different integrals along different contours, and we came up with different Green's functions. But their usefulness really comes in the calculations. So in this problem, we're going to use the retarded Green's function, and hopefully I can show you that it's a little easier to do the integral with that. So if this is our problem, we can really write the solution as a homogeneous solution, which we know in terms of our creation and annihilation operators, plus this integral over the Green's function. And so here we're going to use the retarded Green's function. And the reason for that is because, well, right away we can make a little simplification. But
I don't know, maybe you should take mine?
You think so? Can you guys hear me?
No?
I
don't know.
Sorry. Oh, it's good. Oh, yeah. Good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, last class we derived or showed that the retarded Green's function takes this form. So if I substitute in for this term, I get this. And again, I'm not doing anything tricky here. This is straight out of Peskin and Schroeder. I'm going to keep an eye on the clock because this might take a bit. And then you have this step function, Heaviside function, whatever, that is non-zero only at points. So I'm just evaluating this term, ignoring this.
Could you explain why it's really solution of that equation when you substitute retarded function?
Oh, sure. Well, yeah, because the Green's function satisfies the differential equation with a direct delta function forcing it on the right side. So let's just write that. So if the Green's function satisfies, well, satisfies this, actually, in this form, yeah. So then if you want to get the general solution, if you do this integral of the Green's function, let's just call this, so let's just call this, might as well use the retarded function. So then if we do this integral, then, so the claim is that, well, we have the homogeneous function. Why is this a solution to the equation? Because, well, if you act this operator on this, then certainly acting on this is just equal to zero, because phi naught is a solution to the homogeneous equation. And then if you act it on the integral part, you can take the differentials and the mass into the integral, and you get, I'll just write out this term here, you get this operator acting on and you're integrating over y, so this operator is a differential with respect to x. So
I believe
Okay. And then we said that this here was a solution to the to that equation. So if we put in, so we had this factor of I here. So if we substitute negative I times the Dirac delta function, that just makes this positive 1. And we get this delta function. And of course, by the properties of the delta function, that's just equal to j at x. So that's why the Green's function gives us this solution in a sort of a different form. And it's useful for calculations. But in our case here, we're using the retarded Green's function. And it has this step function here. And then it has this particular form that's, it's here. I don't want to write too much out because could take a while, and you can just see this in the text. Okay. So, got the integration. Okay, so this here is putting in, this here is the retarded Green's function substituted in, and this entire integral is what we're evaluating. If we change the order of integration, we can look at this from a bit of a different perspective. Okay, actually, I'll be all right without this. So, let's change it and do this integration here, 2i cubed. Okay, so the point of using the retarded Green's function was we want to find what the form of this operator is at some later time after this source function has been turned off. So if we say that this j here, this forcing function on that side, is non-zero for only a finite amount of time, then we can just wait until it becomes zero. And then if we wait long enough, we can assume, actually, I don't need to get to that yet. So x0 quite large. And then so this is just equal to 1. Did I say that right? Yeah, I think so. So back to changing this order of integration. We have this, and it's just the usual. Now I'm going to factor out, because it's an integral over dy here, I'm going to factor out e to the negative ipx, or I can't out of the second term. Okay, I'll keep it there for now. E dot x minus y minus e to the I e dot minus y. Okay, so now there's a subtlety here. Let's look at each term individually in this integration. So just to save time so we don't have to work with this, but the analysis is the same. If we write that first term out, then for now we can factor out a factor of e to the negative I p dot x. So we'll have this. Yeah. Okay, so now you can see here that we really have a Fourier transform of the forcing source function. But we also have the fact that when we were evaluating this integral, we were evaluating it for a particular EP. So it looks here, when you look at this function, that this is just a function of x. So why is there this momentum appearing? Well, it's because if you evaluate this entire integral, it's independent of which reference frame you're evaluating it in, because we talked about before how this is a Lorentz invariant integral if you divide by this factor of 2 EP. So, but in this case, if we want to look at just this isolated and see how this how the Fourier transform of the current source is contributing to this field. Then really we have to remember that EP here is fixed. So if we're talking about the four vector P here, really it's zero component, P0 is equal to EP. Or equivalently, that means that we're talking about, when we do this, let's see. Okay, we're going to take the Fourier transform, but the only part of the Fourier transform that's going to matter is when we do the integration over D3P, and we're keeping in mind that P0 is EP. That's equivalent to saying that P squared is actually equal to M squared from our relationship between the energy, the four momentum, the total four momentum, and the mass. I think, does that make sense? Good? Okay. So really the point is that the only contribution of this field that matters to, of the source that matters for the field is the part of it that has, so if we call this the Fourier transform here, J of P, we're talking about only those P's such that this criteria or this condition is met. So only the source, the components of the Fourier transform of the source, which are on the mass shell, as they call it in the book, contribute to the modification of this field at some later time. But
mass shell means very simple, that P square, Minkowski square, Lorentz invariant, equal mass square, and it's called
yeah,
mass shell.
Yeah.
So it's good name.
Yeah. Okay. But now we want to calculate something useful out of this field. And to do that, hopefully I can get this done in time. Well, I'm going to work just with this term here. Remember, I didn't work with this one yet. But you can kind of see what the result would be when you're working with that term. It just turns out to be the Hermitian conjugate of what I'm doing here. But let's see. So really we have here that phi of x is equal to phi naught of x plus I d3p over 2 pi cubed times e to the negative I p dot x over 2 ep times, so we'll call this the Fourier transform, with a tilde on top, and remembering that this is evaluated when P naught equals EP, which is equivalent to saying that P squared equals M squared. And if we write out our normal expression for phi naught in terms of the creation and annihilation operators and combine the integrals, we can rewrite this as, and actually just so I make, don't make a mistake here, copy this out. You can write this as this. E3p over 2 pi cubed. 1 over square root of 2 ep. E to the negative ip dot x. And then this is the important part here. This factor turns what used to be just the creation operator, or the annihilation operator, into now the annihilation operator plus this additional factor that involves the Fourier transform of the forcing source function that was on the right side of our original equation. And remember again that P squared equals M squared here. And then plus, if I had kept that other term, I would have gotten the Hermitian conjugate of this. And okay, so this looks exactly like the field equation before, but not the field equation, like the form of the field before. But now the annihilation operator has been replaced with this operator. So in the text, again, I don't take any credit for this, but they say that you can check this. And it's reasonable to assume then that if the Hamiltonian was originally given in this form, if you remember, it was Hamiltonian is equal to integral over 3 momentum. Of the energy times the.
Sorry.
Yep.
Is there, maybe I'm wrong, another term with plus EX? Or you somehow.
Yeah, so I skipped the second term in the calculations.
Right. So, okay, so you consider plus minus.
Yeah.
The possibility.
Yeah.
B zero.
Yeah, but I didn't do that one because it's sort of the same calculation.
Okay.
Right? Okay, so if the Hamiltonian was originally in this form, it's supposed to be a dagger, then an intuitive generalization, which can be verified by calculation, is to just replace the operators with this and its Hermitian conjugate. And then we can calculate the expectation value of the ground state. Of the vacuum state energy. Now, this is what Dr. Maransky pointed out to me. There's a subtlety here, and that's that even though we're calculating this expectation for some later time t, we can use these original states of the vacuum because we're working in the Heisenberg picture, so the states are time-independent, but the operators carry the time dependence. So if we carry that through, we'll be doing... Let's see, I don't have much time here, but you can see that we'd be doing the vacuum state acting on, now these creation and annihilation operators would have this form, and we'll end up picking up, let's see here, I'll just write out the result. It ends up nicely becoming this value here. So really, the energy, the expectation value of the energy of the vacuum state is just a sum over all modes of the momentum space such that we're on this mass shell again. So it's kind of a neat result. But there's another interpretation of this, and that's that if you expect that the energy, the expectation value of the energy, is equal to a density of particles in existence times each particle's energy. You can write this like here. I'll write this up here. Getting a bit disorganized, but if we write this in this form, put EP there. Squared. Oh, I hope that's legible. But now if we look at this, it really looks like an integral over momentum space of the energies at each momentum times this function here. And if that's equal to the total expectation value of the energy, then this looks like a number density of particles in the vacuum state. So really here we've shown that the source function, if you take its Fourier transform, modes of that that are on the mass shell will create particles. And the total numbers of particles then can be interpreted as, if we get rid of this factor of E, we can really say that N is this, and we've interpreted this, these square brackets there as, well, plus the factor of pi. There. So this gives us an interpretation of how particles can actually be created by some sort of interacting source. Yeah. You guys have any questions? Maybe I should have asked. Yeah. Yeah, you should. The reason that this Green's function was used was because, well, technically you could use anyone, but this one is a retarded function, so it only takes on a value for time less than the time at, you know, it has the Heaviside function. So that simplified the calculation because we could just set that Heaviside function equal to 1 because we're considering later time. Yeah. Anyone else? Anything else? You think, did I miss anything?
Other questions? Okay, so it was a kind of new experience for us. Maybe it will work. So we will see. But Chris, thank you.
Yeah,
thank you very
no
much.
Problem.
Yeah. Okay. So I believe then we will stop here. We are on time. And see you next Wednesday. So I will discuss this wild stuff and more solution of Dirac equation. All this stuff we will continue. So now, yeah. So here you should.